Welcome to Chip Health with Dr. Hans Diehl. On today's broadcast, we'll discover effective ways to be healthy by choice and not by chance. Gaining and maintaining optimum health is possible at any age. That's what thousands are learning at the CHIP programs, the Coronary Health Improvement Project offered across the country and around the world. So get ready to feel better, think clearer, and enjoy a closer walk with God. I'm your CHIP Health host, Charles Mills. It's in the genes. How many times have you heard that said, or perhaps said it yourself to explain an acute or chronic medical condition? My father died of a heart attack when he was 50, and so will I, probably. My grandmother was obese, so I really can't help myself. Or how about, my family members have all lived well into their 90s. I've got the longevity gene working for me. Just how much of an influence do our genes have on our lives? Let's talk with someone who has a very special interest in this topic. Dr. John Kelly is the founder and past president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and is presently a researcher and lifestyle interventionist. He's instrumental in working with universities to explore the integration of lifestyle medicine concepts into the medical system. Dr. Kelly lives in Roanoke, Virginia, where he also directs CHIP programs with great success. Dr. Kelly, what do we know about genes now that we didn't know just two decades ago?
Well, Charles, this field has literally exploded since somewhere around the turn of the century, around 2000 or so. Uh-huh. And in particular, the field that has just mushroomed is what's called epigenetics. Mm-hmm. And this new field of knowledge and insight about genetics really came about after the human genome was sequenced. That was pretty much finished in 2000. And we now have learned that DNA sequence is not nearly as much a sum and substance of the effective genes as we had thought. For example, you know, most of us have never thought about this, even though science has known this for some time, that while we inherit our chromosomes from mom and dad, pairs of chromosomes there, 23 pairs. Mm-hmm. The fact is 50% of chromosomes is DNA, but 50% of the chromosomes we inherit is not DNA. What we're now understanding is we're trying to sort out this human genome of 30,000 plus genes, is that really the non-DNA material in the chromosome is like the jockey sitting on the racehorse, as some have used this analogy. The genes, the DNA sequence, is raw material that the epigenome uses to produce the gene expression, to express our genes. And some amazing knowledge has been added to our understanding now.
It sounds like you're saying that we actually have access to our DNA in some form or another?
Yes, isn't that exciting?
It is.
Yes, you know, where this has come from is, think about this for a moment. We know that every cell in our body comes from that first single cell, mom's ovum and dad's sperm united,
right. And
grew into two cells and then four and eight and 16 until there's literally trillions of them. And every cell in our body has a copy of the same set of chromosomes. Well, why is it then that some of those cells make a right ear that fits so nicely on the side of our head, and some of the cells make a nose that goes on the front? I mean, do you realize, oftentimes we don't think about this, but every cell in our ear has the chromosomes and the genes that it's capable of producing a liver cell or capable of making a toenail. It's this epigenome that controls the gene expression. Most genes in every cell in our body, most genes are quiescent. They're turned off. And so the epigenome really can be thought of as a set of gas pedals and brake pedals that control gene expression, turning on genes, turning off genes. And as you said, science has now really come to realize that our lifestyle factors are the primary determinants of these gene switch settings, turning the genes on and off.
when this epigenome turns it on and off, what is telling the epigenome to do what it does? How does it get its instructions?
That's a great question, and the answer is so exciting. Actually, there are two key determinants. One of them is the effect of neighboring cells within the body. In other words, during embryogenesis, as this developing fetus turns into a full-fledged human being, mm-hmm. there's tremendous amounts of communication going on between tissues and that leading to this differentiation, and that's also done through the epigenome. Mm-hmm. But once we're talking about now an adult or a fetus that's developed and is born, we are now the major influences have to do with nutrition, exercise, even attitudinal differences. It's remarkable now what we're finding is that practically anything that we do that alters our physiology, say our immune system function or serum risk factors for disease, is mediated by the epigenome. And the strongest external effect appears to be exerted by nutrition. This has led to a field called nutrigenomics, a field seeking to develop designer nutrients to turn on and turn off specific genes. And so nutrition, food, is one of the major determinants of gene expression in the human body.
So you're saying that it's possible in the future for a physician to prescribe a certain food or food group to bring about a change in the DNA and the structure of the body?
Absolutely. And now what we're talking about is, you did say it correctly. We can change the structure of the DNA, but we do not know of any ability to change the sequence of the DNA.
Mm.
And this is an important point, especially for those with a little more education in genetics. We are not talking about being able to change the sequence of the DNA, the A, C, T, G, but we can certainly change the structure, meaning covalent modifications. These are stable chemical bonds that change the structure and the conformation is what we call it, of these molecules, and that turns on and turns off gene expression.
Wow. Well, give us a real world example then of how this would benefit us and also how this could do us some damage.
Well, an obvious example that has been tracked down and worked out in great detail in rats, I want to share first, and then I want to share a human study, because not everything done in rats applies to humans. but we like working with animals because initially it's much easier to control their diets and things. In human beings, it's very more difficult. But in Dr. Cheng published a study in 2007 in the Journal of Neuroscience showing that they had tracked the effect of feeding a pregnant rat a high-fat diet. And this high-fat diet produced overexpression of genes on chromosome 3 in the developing fetus. The fetus was in the mother's womb. The mother was eating this high-fat diet, but it was exerting an effect causing overexpression of a gene on chromosome 3 in the developing baby. This led to an overproliferation of brain cells at the base of the brain in the developing fetus that were producing neuropeptides that led to a behavior phenotype is what we call it, but behaviors in the after birth in this offspring that increased its appetite for fat, increased its caloric intake, increased its blood lipids, meaning it had risk factors for heart disease, increased early puberty, just an amazing parallel with the changes we see in young people in our own country.
Oh, yes.
And then a study published, I think, in a year later in of Proceedings of the National Academy of Science by Dr. Dean Ornish and his team did an amazing study looking at dietary change in human beings. And what they did was they had 30 men with prostate cancer that agreed to undergo a lifestyle intervention program, largely vegetable or vegan diet, low-fat, whole-food diet with stress management and exercise. And in 90 days, they compared the gene expression in the cancerous prostate tissue using biopsies of the prostate to the way gene expression at the beginning of the study. And there were hundreds, literally hundreds of genes that had as much as a twofold or greater change in gene expression in these men. And in general, those known to be cancer-producing were decreased in gene expression. In other words, they were being turned off, whereas those that were protective for cancer or cancer-fighting were being turned on. And so this lifestyle intervention, the plant-based diet, low-fat exercise, this had been shown conclusively to also work in human beings. And so I know a number of patients who, upon learning about that, began self-prescribing, because the program, this is the exciting thing, Charles, is that what we're talking about here is not some high-tech thing that you have to buy from some pharmaceutical. This is simply, if you go to the grocery store, you can choose foods that are therapeutic, that can literally turn off the unhealthy genes and turn on the healthy ones.
This is the human counterpart of the T. Colin Campbell study where he showed the genes were turning on and off in laboratory rats.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, Dr. Campbell's work showed conclusively that protein content, especially animal source protein, was capable to turn on and turn off AB. And here, in this particular study, as you can understand, it wouldn't have been ethical to then turn around there were benefits.
Yeah, right.
So in humans, it's not ethical to then remove the treatment and expose them to increased cancer. But we have every reason to believe that it would exhibit the same, AB effect.
Because that happened in the rats in the T. Colin Campbell study.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to stay with this a little bit longer. You're talking about prostate cancer here. When we come back, I want to ask you, Dr. Kelly, what are some of the foods that someone who may be facing prostate cancer or cancer in general, what are some of the foods that would help in turning off those genes? Very important information here. And we'll talk with Dr. John Kelly, a researcher and lifestyle interventionist, about this when we return. So stay tuned. Did you know that cow's milk, contrary to popular belief, may do a body harm? Cow's milk can trigger allergies and asthma, especially in African American and Asian people. It may also trigger type 1 diabetes in the young. So, what's the perfect health beverage? Got water? Actually, cow's milk is the perfect food for growing calves.
I'm Dr. Hans Dior, inviting you to join the people in the know and enroll in the next CHIP program in your area. It can make all the difference.
Hi, I'm Norm Pankel. I used to take 14 pills a day. They cost me about $312 a month. Now I'm off all these pills. Going to CHIP was the best bargain I ever had.
For more information about the Coronary Health Improvement Project and to find resources to help you live a healthier, happier life, visit chiphealth.org. That's chiphealth.org. Our guest today is Dr. John Kelly. He's a researcher and lifestyle interventionist, and we're talking about something that almost sounds science fiction. If it wasn't true, we wouldn't believe it, but we have the ability, according to studies, and Dr. Kelly is telling us about that, we have the ability to, in some degree, determine how susceptible our bodies are to developing cancer. Am I right in saying that, Dr. Kelly?
Absolutely. In fact, it's interesting. Dr. Randy Jertle, J-I-R-T-L-E, who's one of the lead researchers on this, doing some of the early research in mice, actually has written, I believe I saw this statement by him on the Discovery magazine, but he says the modern understanding, now our up-to-date understanding of the epigenome, introduces the concept of free will into our idea of genetics. You know, in the past, we've had this idea that, well, I'm born with these genes. What can you do? I mean, in fact, some of the early advocates of this idea were saying that, well, it's all in the genes. There's no choice to this at all. And now, one of the primary leading experts said, just as you did, that we actually now have the molecular basis to understand how our free choice actually operates in our genetic makeup. And that's exciting.
And it sounds like we're handing down, for good or for evil, what we do to ourselves, to our children, and the next generations.
Oh, this is so true. Absolutely. And what's exciting is, as we are now actually deciphering, if you will, the molecular basis for these things, as Dr. Oh, I'm forgetting, blanking on the name, but a gentleman who wrote in the Journal of Carcinogenesis not that long ago said, in the last decade, this kind of research in cancer research and nutrients has just mushroomed. And we now, as I'm quoting him, he says, we now know there are a myriad of nutritional substances that alter the carcinogenic process at the cellular level. And many of these things are simple constituents in our diet. I know you want to talk about the Watson, but let me share one more amazing thing about this.
Sure.
Dr. Feinberg, who's Johns Hopkins, I believe, he has written in the Journal of American Medical Association. This was published in 2008, volume 299. He said, his article is entitled "Epigenetics at the Center of Modern Medicine." What we're talking about here, I want to be cautious, not overstate it, but I don't want to understate. The fact is, as Dr. Feinberg says, epigenetics is at the epicenter of modern medicine because it helps explain the relationship between an individual's genetic background, the environment that they have lived in and have experienced, the aging process, and disease. And this is almost like the holy grail of medicine, to understand something that can pull all these pieces together in explaining and understanding medicine. So I'm just excited, as you probably can tell. I'm excited about this because, as a clinician in lifestyle medicine, you know, some of my we colleagues, we all of us in each profession love to tease each other in our special way. And so my colleagues are often ask me, well, you're a lifestyle medicine doctor, what do you treat? You know, I'm a urologist, I treat the plumbing and so on. And I say, well, I treat the volition. And in a very real sense, those of us who use lifestyle interventions to treat disease, this is a voluntary act. You cannot do this to the patient. The patient must elect to do this themselves. And so I'm much aware of the importance of convincing people that this can work, because the first thing you have to do is convince a patient, well, I can do this. And then I find very much associated with that is convincing them that I want to do this. Meaning, some people say, well, do we really live longer, or does it just seem longer because, you know, we deny ourselves all the pleasures of life? But in reality, we do live longer. There's good evidence of that. And so we find that it's so important to share with people actual taste samples, actual recipes, actual set of tools. In essence, food is literally becoming the medicine.
Yes.
Here. And so we share with them a variety of recipes and taste samples during our treatment program, and most other lifestyle medicine doctors too. This is not me specifically, but that's the general approach to a lifestyle intervention: is educating the patient, sharing the science for how this works, then sharing the practical, how do you do it, what do I need to change? And you asked a question earlier about that before the break. And let me just say this, that if I were to summarize it, I think the author Michael Pollan has come pretty close in a way. His book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and some of the other books he's written. And he says the three rules he's come up with are to eat food, and then he puts in parentheses, not food-like substances.
good choice of words,
yeah,
there.
For example, Pringles are not potato chips. They are fat held together with potato starch. And then he says his second rule is mostly plants. And that is so true. We need to eat far more plants than we're eating. We're just eating way too few. And as many of the experts tell us, there's no evidence that there's any minimum requirement for animal foods in the diet. Hmm. So you could become a total vegetarian or a vegan if you wished, with good results. But you must eat mostly plants. And then his third rule I thought was good. And that is not too much. And it's true that if we would just eat a little less than we're used to, it will have a real asset. But so what we do is I recommend whole plant foods eaten with as little processing as possible. That's the optimal approach.
And, of course, that's what the whole message of the Coronary Health Improvement Project is, and you're very much involved with that in the Roanoke area, right?
Oh, absolutely. We have an outpatient lifestyle center, mm-hmm. and we use the CHIP Coronary Health Improvement Project as our core curriculum for the intensive phase. And so it's a very solid educational program, helping our patients understand how food and lifestyle, other factors affect their physiology. I'm very familiar with it. It's very solid, and it, I believe the Dr. Deal's mantra, you might say, is whole foods as grown.
Yes,
plant
right.
foods as grown, right. I guess.
Now let's keep our promise here. I mentioned before that we're going to go shopping and we're going to find out what foods at the grocery store we can actually use to turn off cancer genes. It sounds incredible that we can do that, but study after study, both in the laboratory rats and in human beings, have proven this beyond a shadow of a doubt. Take us shopping, Dr. Kelly, there in Roanoke. Let's go over to the Food Lion or whatever is nearby, and what should we put in our baskets that can actually help us fight cancer?
Well, you know, this is very practical. And we actually do include, by the way, a food tour as part of our intervention program because mm-hmm. it's so practical. So what we do is we'll start off just giving an overview and we say, okay, basically the foods that we want to emphasize and we want to eat more of are generally found on the perimeter of the store. And the foods that are in the center of the store towards the aisles, we probably want to eat less of in general. And so what you'll find in most grocery stores is that the foods that are whole, that are ready, that can be eaten as is, for vegetables, fruits, and so on, will tend to be around the perimeter.
That's true.
Also, whole grain breads tend to be oftentimes on the other side of the store, but on the perimeter. And what do we find in the center of the store? Well, usually that's where we find the highly processed, food-like substances, as Dr. Pollan might say, Mr. Pollan. And so Dr. Deal has a lovely catchy phrase. He says, avoid crinkly bags.
Yes, he does.
If it comes in a crinkly bag or a box, you know, Dr. Dennis Burkitt, famous for the Burkitt's lymphoma discovery he made, but also is famous for fiber, the guru of fiber. His comment about some of the cereal boxes, especially the ones, the highly refined cereals for children, is that it would be better to dump out the cereal and eat the box. and there's actually some good evidence that he might have been right about that.
Really?
Because,
really?
I mean, we're talking about breakfast candy in many cases.
Yeah.
And this is part of why we're having an obesity epidemic. Do we realize that the American Academy of Pediatrics is now recognizing this obesity epidemic, has suggested that doctors need to start tracking risk factors at 2 years of age in these overweight children and begin statin medications for their cholesterol at age 8. I mean, we can't go this way. We need to shop on the outer perimeter. So the things we want to buy, another way of looking at it is if it needs no nutrition label, it's probably a very healthy food. So you're not going to find a nutrition label on an apple. You're not going to find a nutrition label on a head of lettuce, broccoli. You know, in mentioning that, one of the food groups that are particularly important in fighting cancer, but I would say all really in any kind of a condition that you're wanting to improve the immune function, you want to emphasize these leafy plant foods of color. The dark, like eggplant, or deep colored cole crops like broccoli, kale, spinach, and it's good. The other foods like fruits are also good, but these leafy greens and dark colored plants are a great friend, and we need to eat lots more of them. You know, these can be eaten without cooking. And people think our initial impression is rabbit foods, I've heard people say. But, you know, my wife, Sally, and I have a lovely thing we generally include with our breakfast, not every day, but frequently. And that is we'll take and blend some grapes, maybe some pineapples, maybe some crisp apples. And then in this blender, we will put a large amount of green leafy vegetables, kale, spinach, broccoli, greens. You know, you don't just eat the broccoli heads. You can eat the broccoli leaves. And we blend this up. It makes a delicious, natural smoothie. No fibers lost. None is taken out. We eat the entire thing. As I typically make mine thick enough, I can eat it with a spoon, so it encourages mastication and not make a drink to just swallow. And this makes a great way to add these greens to your diet.
Well, there you go. You have heard from Dr. John Kelly, researcher and lifestyle interventionist, about cancer fighting with a spoon and a fork. That's the way it's done. And he's saying that not only does that go in and help your cancer fighting, but it messes around there with your DNA that you pass on to your generations to come, and they come with genes ready to do battle with cancer as well. I can't think of a better way of encouraging our listeners, Dr. Kelly, than to tell them that what they eat can make a difference, not only for themselves, but for their children and their grandchildren. Fantastic stuff. Thank you, Dr. Kelly. Appreciate our time has flown by. Listener, I invite you to stop by www.chiphealth.org for more information about how to live a happy and healthy life. Until next time, I invite you to enjoy health by choice, not by chance. Goodbye, everyone.